You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to a special Times Higher Education podcast. My name is Tim Savula. I'm head of content for the World Summit series here at Times Higher Education. And you're listening to us in the back of the bus on the way down the Alps from Davos on the way to Zurich, where Times Higher Education has been presenting some new data on university-industry collaboration. I'm joined in the back of the bus by Phil Beatty, the editorial director of our World University Rankings, and Mohamed El Alsati, who is the vice president for content and analytics at Elsevier. And they can tell us a bit more about some of the new data that was presented to university leaders yesterday. Phil.
So we were working really with the Global University Leaders Forum. There's a WEF group of top universities, 27 institutions all across the world, but very much concentrated among the world's elite. And given that we're at Davos and there's a really strong focus on how we're driving the knowledge economy, we decided to evaluate the contribution these particular universities are making to the knowledge economy as a way of opening a conversation about university-industry relationships. So in terms of the data, Times Higher Education analyzed some of the material in the World University Rankings. We found that these 27 institutions make up less than 2.5% of the 1,000-plus institutions that we rank in the world, but they're responsible for 11% of all research income attracted. They're getting about $3.3 billion a year in funding directly from the private sector, from industry, about $20 billion in total, but $3 billion of that is coming from businesses and industry. So we wanted to explore the depth and breadth and extent of those relations, and that's where we partnered with Elsevier, looking at patent citations and looking at publication volumes to get some additional insights into those relationships. So,
Mohamed, what were some of the key findings that came out of the data?
Yeah, so it was interesting to look at the Gulf as a group. We've done many previous analyses looking at different groups of universities, but soon it became clear that the Gulf was a special group, let's say. So one of the things we found, for example, when we looked at the world share of publication research output as expressed in publications, articles, conference papers, etc., was that Gulf was ranked third in the world if we would compare Gulf against some research-intensive nations. So their share was 7%, which ranks third, much higher than the UK, Germany, Japan, Italy, and France. We also found out when we looked at the interaction with the industry through patents, which is a typical proxy to measure innovation but also commercialization of research, that the Gulf had the second largest patent citation share, second to the US only. We also found out, for example, when we looked at with whom they collaborate most, that Microsoft was by far the largest partner, or the partner with most collaboration has happened over the last 5 years. And then to finish, maybe another interesting outcome we found, which was the quality of the research produced by the Gulf as a group. It was by far the highest we ever measured before, at 1.84, much higher than countries like the UK at 1.57, knowing that the UK is the top country worldwide when it comes to quality of research produced by academics.
And as we were in Davos, we were fortunate to be joined by a distinguished panel of university leaders to discuss some of the research that you presented. We had a panel with Y.S. Chi, the global chairman of Elsevier, Eng Che Tan, the president of the National University of Singapore, Lino Gazella, president of ETH Zurich, Alice Gast, president of Imperial College London, and Suzanne Fortier, president of McGill University in Canada. In the conversations that followed, what stood out for you, Phil?
Well, I think for me, the interesting thing was obviously, A, providing some hard data that demonstrates the contribution universities are making. I think there's a genuine sense, a perception that universities don't like working with business. They see it as getting their hands dirty. There's a challenge there, a cultural problem there. So actually just demonstrating the sheer scale and extent of these really productive relationships is very important. But really it was a question of exploring the nature of those relationships. And I think there is a sense that there's maybe a bit of fear that, you know, could massive corporations like Google, you know, usurp universities in conducting their own research, not bothering to include universities, poaching staff and talent from universities. So there's an issue around the culture clashes, but I think the big takeaway for me was that fundamental sense that universities will always have an incredibly important role to play in carrying out the kind of research that doesn't have immediate, obvious commercial benefits, that is curiosity-driven, that may go down blind alleys, that is high risk in the sense it might not produce any commercial returns at all, it might fail, that universities need that safe space and they need the basic levels of public funding to protect those safe spaces that then will lead to future commercialization, future discoveries that could be invested in by companies. I think that sense that we need to protect the unique role of universities by giving them the safe space to have the curiosity-led research and not to demand too much immediate short-term impact from what they do, because I think that would narrow the scope for discovery and narrow the scope for creativity. So that sense of protecting the universities and the unique elements that they bring to this whole arena of knowledge transfer.
I think it was Lino Gazzella and Alice Gast who both quoted Einstein, who famously said that not everything that counts can be counted, and not everything that can be counted counts, and that seemed to chime quite a lot with the audience. Mohammed, was there anything that you were thinking about when you take back to your office in Amsterdam?
Working for a corporate myself, so I was sitting on one side of the story, listening also to the these great leaders of the academic sector. What I thought I'm taking with me, certainly try to share with my colleagues, is this consensus that seemed to be achieved yesterday during the conversation about the need of corporates to tap into the resource of talents that sits at the university at early stage while maintaining the continuation of the academic research itself, meaning letting the same resources potentially go back to the academic sector to train the next generation of talents that we will need in. And by doing that, you maintain the chain and the vortex of creating new talents as we go. So I think that the major message for us is continue fostering this collaboration with the academic sector, allowing people to come early to have a trainee positions, share the knowledge as much as possible, invest by not just, you know, writing checks, as our chairman said, writing them out, but actually get into the lab, so to say, try to understand what they are doing, bring them in to also work on some of the challenges that we are facing ourselves. So it's no more about just saying it or writing out checks, but actually really intensely, jointly and tightly work together.
Thank you. And you can read the full story, which will be published today on timeshighereducation.com and available in our magazine with some fantastic infographics showing some of the data really clearly. But now we're going to hand you over to listen to some of our guests who were there in Davos last night and their take on the event and the research. Thank you.
So ladies and gentlemen, dear colleagues, vice chancellor, presidents from universities all over the world, for me this gathering together we had today, the golf is always like psychotherapy. I get to talk with those people who have the same problems as I have and to get some support and some pats on the back, that helps a lot. So it is a great pleasure to have you here all tonight again.
Alice, if I could start with you. So we've talked about this sort of notion, or you've talked about this notion in terms of international collaboration as hybrid vigor, where different cultures, different backgrounds come together and there's a sort of additional creativity there. Does that apply in terms of the cultural relationship between universities and businesses? There's often this sense of a culture clash. There's issues around we do things differently in higher education. We don't have those short-term goals. We're not as worried about commercialization. But is there a sort of a crucial element there where the difference is actually very important, or do you need to get closer together as organizations?
There is a very important element that comes from collaboration with other sectors, with industry in particular. And I would say that some of the times when it's most fruitful is when it's really a true collaboration. And I feel that over the last few decades, a lot of the work with industry has changed from corporations, industries coming to universities with a problem and saying, you work on this and then report back to us, to a much more collaborative approach. And we have a number of university technology centers where we have collaborations with a company and we have embedded staff from that company in our labs. And furthermore, our staff will go visit and spend time in their labs. And I think what's really fruitful about this is the real true fundamental base of all this, underpinning all of this success, is fundamental research, discovery research, new ideas that come up, things that people pursue. And you spent some time at the beginning pointing out the funding of research and how important that is. It is important to realize that behind all of this is true discovery research. If you have a collaborator in your laboratory and you're pursuing that fundamental research, it's the collaborator from the industry who can say, hang on, that could be useful for this. And so you get that natural connection to applications that the academic might not have thought about without knowing the industry that well. And so the research doesn't get shifted, but it gets expanded, and one can now apply new ideas into those applications. And I think that makes it a two-way street and makes it very beneficial, and new things can come from it.
Suzanne, if I can move to you, staying on this sort of culture clash issue or that arm's length element, I mean, you've talked earlier to me about this sense of the academics feeling that perhaps working with business is somehow beneath them, or they're getting their hands dirty there. So there's an issue that perhaps universities need to address around extolling the virtues of that activity.
Yeah.
Is that something you're trying? I mean, it was interesting to see McGill's got there's some fantastic hard data
yes.
there, which shows the benefits of this sort of collaboration with GSK,
yes.
even if it's low volume.
Well, I will make some comments based on large on my experience as the president of the research agency in Canada that supported research in science and engineering. And what surprised me when I was in the agency and doing that work is that there are some old myths that are still within the academic environment. And I think that we need to bust those myths. And there's nothing that will help us more to do that than to have data, to have evidence. Otherwise, I think they'll persist and contribute to, in still not in the academic environment, valuing the kind of interactions we have with industry as we should, and particularly in our reward system. So I'll mention three myths that I heard repeatedly. One was, of course, if you work with industry, all you're doing is incremental research. It's not that interesting. It's all incremental, which is not true at all. Another one is, of course, you're not a top discovery researcher. You work with industry as sort of a second option rather than a first option. And that was another myth. And there's another one I noted here. Oh, yes, of course. And that is that there is almost a competition or a clash between curiosity-driven research and purpose-driven research, and particularly in funding agency, money given to purpose-driven research stealing away from the fundamental research. And people often view that anything you do with industry, as I mentioned, is incremental. So many did not realize the amount of fundamental research that is going there. I think we really need data to show that these are all myths, and that there is real value. And in many ways, in the comments that Alice made, when I did talk to the researchers, and in fact, in the data that we had at the agency, we could see that the top discovery research has a higher incidence of working with industry than those who were ranked lower in the discovery grants program. And when I talked to people, what they said is, well, you know, I'm inspired by what I see in working with my colleagues in the industry. I get into new areas of research I hadn't even thought about before, because what I see in their work opened these new avenues for me. So I think that whole, in terms of the culture in university, we need the data, the kind of data you are showing us today, to start moving the culture to a greater valuing of the type of work we can do in partnership. These data are great. I think you're just showing a little bit, the tip of the iceberg maybe, because there's increasingly different models of interaction with industry. I think the transactional model, of course, is still used, but we're seeing increasingly models where there's a consortium of different universities with industry, much more open, and the kind of investments that are made there might not be, I don't believe, would be cut by your methodology. So I think it will be important to start looking at these new models of long-term partnership through consortia between various universities and the private sector.
So we have a representative of business, YSG, perhaps more in your capacity at RELX Group rather than as the academic publisher Elsevier. I mean, what's your perception there in terms of how much you need universities to support your activities in terms of the commercial research you do, and what are the sort of lessons we can learn about these culture clashes? How can we work better together, universities and businesses?
Universities have suddenly become really, really important, not just as a customer, but as our partner. Mm-hmm. And we are entering into more and more of these collaborations that both Alice and Suzanne have mentioned, where we either allow them to come into our operations and work with us, or we go in there ourselves, and it's no longer just a funding model. So we used to just write checks, and as Alice mentioned, you know, tell us what came out. It's not like that at all. It is also critical for us to look to the universities as a source of talent. Mm-hmm. And I know you probably will hate us for stealing so many of your good students before they even finish their degrees. But we are in need right now, and we're just short of people that are well trained by you before they are even finished, because the industry side is transforming so quickly that we can't wait until they're done.
I just wanted to say we spent much of the afternoon talking about the fourth industrial revolution and how we as universities will have an impact and how we can make a difference. And one aspect is thinking about how to deal with this great need for talent. Mm-hmm. And I think that we should perhaps start welcoming the fact that you want our great students even before they graduate, but you should also perhaps consider having them come back and finishing. Yeah. And I think that if we look at credentialing and how we do it now, mm-hmm. and you look at the gig economy, and you look at the way the world's changing rapidly, students would have a tremendous benefit for going off and having an experience mm-hmm. in your place, and then coming
Absolutely.
Back, sharing that with their classmates as well as their professors and such. And we're even talking about that in the UK with regard to conversion masters, where one can start learning artificial intelligence, machine learning, etc. But go off into your sector, Absolutely. Have an internship, be it pharmaceuticals or banking or publishing or data or whatever, and then come back. And that will make the program, the educational programs, all the more rich.
I am a firm believer that an education is more than just training and skills. Mm-hmm. It is a comprehensive program that goes way beyond just the pure skills that you have to, that you in industry, of course, need. But we as university leaders have an obligation, a responsibility towards our students to prepare them not just for the next job, mm-hmm. but for the 20 jobs that you mentioned that will be down the road. Mm-hmm. And to be prepared for that, you need much more than to be able to solve differential equations or program an artificial intelligence mm-hmm. program. You need to have a broader view that includes many, many societal aspects, social sciences, humanities. You need to train yourself. You need to be able to learn. That's probably the most important thing that you have to convey. Social responsibilities. And if I may, even there, we have to convey to our students some values. We need to talk about new models of cooperation between industry and academia. You said that, industry is shying away more and more from risks. Yeah. I'm not so sure. It's true, but it's not just the risk that they're shying away. It's also a risk times time that they're shying away. So industry is willing to take up huge risks if the payback time, the return of investment is short, that they can plan with it. Mm. Yeah. It's a fierce war. Let's not call it war. It's a fierce competition for the best brains, and competition is okay as long as it is fair. And as long as it is transparent, and for this I'm very grateful to you, Times Higher Education, and to you, Elsevier, because the data that you provide will allow us to make this discussion on a rational basis and not on an emotional basis, and I think we need to move in that direction, otherwise we'll never get forward.
Yeah. If we could open it up to the audience in terms of questions, reactions. Peter, do you have anything to contribute?
And I'm wondering whether one could imagine collaborations of industry with philosophers who study ethics, with artists who are interested in creativity and innovation and how you see things and hear things, and, right? With historians for greater context. Or is that just a pipe dream on my part and it really isn't going to ever happen?
So, no, we don't know how to do it yet. There's no data to evidence, but one thing we can say is that at the undergraduate level, at least, not the PhD level, but at undergraduate level, some of the most successful people that we are recruiting today are not necessarily CS majors or biology major, but they are history majors and philosophy majors who then go on to graduate school work in those STEM or engineering field. It's very interesting that as we recruit these people, it is visible to us that those whose job can be replaced by machines aren't the best people to hire. They need to have the liberal arts mindset on top of the skill set.
I would make a little cautionary note on your last slide, because when you start to compare the Gulf group to other groups of universities or to a country or something, I think you're taking we're a wonderful group. I love the Gulf group. It's a very wonderful group. We spent a lot of time today talking about diversity of our group and how there's a lack of representation from some parts of the world, and there are things we'd like to do to make it more inclusive. And so I mean, it's fine to use us because I think it's a really interesting set to look at how we interact and such. But when you roll it all up and say, here's the Gulf group, it's a construct. We're a club, and we're proud to be in the club, but it is a club. Yeah.
There is a very famous law. If you have a certain amount of resources, call it money, and you want to do two things, and you do with the same money, you try to achieve both objectives, you will achieve none of them. So you should reserve some sort of resources for one objective, be inclusive, helping people that have been left behind, and some of the money or the resources for being excellent and being the top number one. If you mix the two, you will waste the money, and it's not what we can afford.
So let's wrap up the official part of proceedings, and thank you very much indeed for giving your time.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.